We return to the second half of the speech given by historian Paula Giddings on the life of African-American women's rights advocate and anti-lynching crusader Ida B. Wells. The talk, titled Ida B. Wells and the Beginning of the Civil Rights Movement, was presented to the African-American Women Scholars Conference. Once again, Paula Giddings.
And what was interesting in this period of time, of course, was that, I mean, racism and sexism has always been around, but became ideology in the late 19th century, was ideology proved by science. Our sexual organs, scientists said, had a special configuration, one which was primitive and linked to that of orangutans. I mean, this is in the scientific journals. The size of our buttocks, also in binary opposition to white women, was another physiological, concrete, tangible sign of our sexuality in this belief system. It was that belief that inspired the phenomena of Sarah Bartman. You know that name, Sarah Bartman? You know the name, the Hottentot Venus? Who in the early 1800s, this 20-year-old South African woman, Sarah Bartman, was exhibited in London for 5 years, after which she died. What drew such public interest in England was the size of Miss Bartman's buttocks. What drew the interest of the medical and science establishment was the shape of her sexual organs, thought to be a model of ape-like primitivity. When she died at the age of 25, after being exhibited for 5 years, her genitalia was removed in an autopsy and presented in such a way as to allow one to see the nature of the labia. Her organs were then given to the Musée de l'Homme in Paris, where they are still on display. Such ideas laid black women open, quite literally, to sexual exploitation. With us, freedom did not mean protection. After being sexually used by in the 19th century by Union soldiers, I mean, this was our first taste of freedom, liberated by the Union soldiers. After being used by them, after being treated as like business as usual by white Southerners, and in addition, by the late 19th century, terrorized by violent rape as a way to reaffirm slavery of black men and women, was our experience that we must always understand happened simultaneously with the lynching of black men. A sure sign of a slave, I don't care what the Emancipation Proclamation says, a sure sign of a slave is sexual vulnerability. If we can't protect ourselves, we are nothing but slaves. We were the reason behind the ideas of sexual prowess of black men, who would have to be potent to satisfy us, the beliefs went. Black women were also responsible for the entire race's immorality, including that of black men. That's how our own rape was rationalized. And finally, it was the binary opposition of black and white women who drew black men to the latter. It was believed. It was the very contrast of purity, fragility, beauty, and femininity that white women possessed, which attracted black men to them, and which made them rapists. What Wells attempted to undo was not only the lynchings, but the entire paradigm which drove it. She challenged those binary oppositions. She wrote that black men were not guilty of rape, white men were. Black women were not sexually immoral, white women were. That's the editorial that got her thrown out of Memphis. White women weren't getting raped, black women were. And as she said, without reproof from church, state, or press. It was this aspect of the campaign that particularly inspired black women who, catalyzed by Wells's action, would come together in a national organization called the National Association of Colored Women in 1896. Like Wills, some of its leading lights, like Mary Church Terrell and Fanny Barrier Williams and Anna Julia Cooper, taking an independent direction from the general racial movement. They did the racial thing, but they also took their own feminist direction, engaged in issues of sexual exploitation of black men, black women, by white men. You know, I always love thinking about, because, you know, these ladies, now you know what these ladies were like. It's these little club ladies. And in many ways, they're very well educated, very proper. Mary Church Terrell always had a string of white pearls and gloves wherever she went. And boy, but they fanned out and talked about this issue in public forums all across the country. Here, these, in many ways, a Victorian sensibility. In 1893, for example, the Chicago club woman Fanny Barrier Williams, who had attended by, you know, the New England Conservatory of Music, I mean, told white women at the World's Columbian Exposition that black women were tired of their criticism vis-a-vis black women's morality. They didn't need criticism, they needed protection. And she said, quote, "I do not want to disturb the serenity of this conference by suggesting why this protection is needed and the kind of man against whom it is needed." She did disturb the serenity of the conference. This aspect of the campaign was as important to the notion of liberation as any other, but the circle was left incomplete. What Wells and these other brave women were precluded from doing, what they could not do, was publicly critique the inner lives of the black community at a time when the combination of the economy and racism were creating the first ghettos, when drug and alcohol abuse, there's so much of this period that's so much like our own, when drug and alcohol abuse was rampant, causing domestic violence. Cocaine was used even then, you know. Cocaine was evident in the late 19th century, actually much earlier. Cocaine was given to slaves, make them work harder. We don't need to say anything more about cocaine. And by the way, they were precluded from an internal critique of the community that was experiencing high rates of infant mortality because of female substance abuse. They could not publicly critique domestic violence in a black community at a time when men, as Wells actually reported, could be lynched for wife beating. At least that was the rationale that was given. They could not publicly critique motherhood at a time when it was so important to prove the inherent morality of black women. The criminal acts of lynching and rape, given sanction by the sexual difference of black people, in other words, did not allow even a constructive criticism of the behavior in that community. And it was a behavior that, like now, was killing us. In the late 19th century, there was an incurable venereal disease disproportionately affecting black people. It was called syphilis. At best, sociological tracts such as those under the auspices of Du Bois at Atlanta University in the late 19th century told of these things in vivid detail. But in terms of the public discourse, we were silenced and we suffered. In some ways, we still suffer, don't we? We certainly are still silenced. Our deep and painful legacy of the past makes us shriek when the critique is even suggested, even in fiction. We shrieked Color Purple with colored girls who considered suicide, with Anita Hill, not because we denied these things happened, but because we didn't want it to come to the public light. We didn't want white people to hear about it. We didn't want that image again of us being sexually different and diametrically opposed to what the false standards were of middle-class white people. And so we silenced it, particularly in a case like Anita Hill's, who reported a black-on-black sexual crime against a man of influence in the white community. And so she broke a very important taboo, a an old standing taboo that once was important for our protection, but now is literally destroying us because we still have a difficult time dealing with sexuality issues that are unmediated by questions of racism. We can talk about rape by white people, and we could talk about this, and we could talk about how great we were in Africa, and we came here, we got corrupted. We can do all of that, but we cannot talk about very successfully black on black sexuality issues, both the positive, by the way, and the negative about it at all, unmediated by questions of racism. You know, we talk about our tremendous power as women, and we certainly have an extraordinary history. But I wonder how many of us empowered black women really control the nature of our sexual relationships with men. How much power do we have over that? Which maybe is why we have a cult, what I call a cult of motherhood in our community. Why, according to a National Council of Negro Women, 58% of black women report that they never use contraceptives. Why 40% of unmarried teenagers who get pregnant report that they purposely did so. Why the date rape and the abuse continue and is nevertheless underreported by black women. The discourse must begin, and it is a feminist discourse. And it is a discourse that says that sexism is at least as destructive in our community as racism. In this day, in this time, that the poverty of families and the poverty of children are largely a gender issue. That the high incidence of violence in the black community also includes battering and rape and domestic violence aimed at black women. That homicide, we always hear, is the most prevalent cause of death of young black males between 17 and 25. That is true, and that is a tragedy. It is also the most prevalent cause of death of black females in that age group. And by saying this to you, by feeling so urgent about it, I am not, and I always feel, because we always feel uncomfortable about dealing with some of this stuff, am I trying to say in the manner of flawed Western logic of dualistic thinking that all black men are bad and women innocent victims? No. Am I trying to trash black men? No. Am I saying this because I have some personal problem regarding male-female relationships? No. Am I mad at somebody? No. I'm talking about it because it's real. And we have been silenced in dealing with it. But mostly I want to talk about it because it's only when we begin this discourse and this discussion can we begin to heal ourselves, to heal our relationships in a world where we need each other so desperately. You know, there was something very interesting in that report of Atlanta University I was telling you about on the leadership of Du Bois. It was a very critical, I mean, it talked about all the stuff, tuberculosis, venereal disease, and we bring it on ourselves, had nothing to do with poverty, had nothing to do with slavery, that it was our own bad decisions about our lives. It was painful to read. Until the very end paragraph, the last paragraph, the sociologist, a black man who had conducted the study said, I know this is very critical, but one reason I'm so critical is because it means that if we are responsible so much of this ourselves, it means it's within our hands to heal it. It means it doesn't depend on external conditions changing for us to heal and become whole again. It means it's just a question of education. So I have so much more optimism, knowing that much of this is from the inside, because that's how we can heal it. He said, if I thought all this was due to outside stuff that I can't control, I'd be very depressed. Which makes me think sometimes one reason why, in some ways, we're freer than ever before, but more depressed than ever before, is because we feel so powerless when we shouldn't. And you know, the days of binary opposition in terms of sexuality is dead. Desegregation and the sexual revolution, among other things, killed it. You know, black people, men and women, have very high in polls. They talk about women's rights issues. We score the highest of any group. Half the, though, when you mention the word feminism, people go crazy. And I think the difference is that feminism demands analysis of sexuality and sexual politics. And it's still very hard for us to deal with it. But we must. We must continue the struggle that started in the 1890s and take it to the next level. Ida Wells began a discourse. Alice Walker and Tazaki, Michelle Wallace brought it back to the surface. Anita Hill gave us the possibility of a transformative modern discourse that can help save us. Let us be silent no more. Let us carry on the legacy. It will tell us who we are and how we got here. It is the stuff that movements are made of. Thank you.
And that was a speech given by Paula Giddings on the work of the legendary African-American anti-lynching activist and feminist Ida B. Wells, and how it helps us understand race and gender today. Giddings teaches African-American studies at Smith College and is the author of a number of acclaimed books, including When and Where I Enter, The Impact of Black Women on Race and Sex in America, and most recently, Ida, A Sword Among Lions, Ida B. Wells and the Campaign Against Lynching, published by Amistad Books. My name is Sasha Lilly.